And she points out that in reading these words, she feels belittled to have to ask someone else's opinion about their acceptance. So there are lots of things to talk about. It's a good issue to talk about. But first, let me welcome Tom Robbins. Tom, you there? Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Yes. Well, you're probably a bit happier than last time we had you on the air. Most of my listeners are pretty depressed right now, but I do want to congratulate you. And you know, we're all Americans here. Congratulations on your candidate winning the presidency.
Well, thanks, Mark. It was a lot of hard work. We mobilized a lot of young volunteers going into battleground states, and in the end, it was a great time, and it paid off.
Well, let me ask you this, because you did, no question, the Republicans mobilized people, the Democrats mobilized people. We had the highest voter turnout since 1968, and that's including the fact, as I mentioned in a op-ed that I've been writing, that includes 4 million Gore voters that stayed home in California and New York because their votes really didn't matter. If that had happened, of course, the popular vote would have been about even, but the electoral vote counts, and George Bush won Ohio. My question is, when you say that you're motivating young voters, Tom, the one group the Democrats clearly won in this race, we lost a lot of groups, but we won young voters by a 10-point margin. I don't know. Are those the statistics that you're seeing?
Well, the fact that the Democratic team won the young vote by a 10% margin, you think that they have done a little bit better job in that respect. I think the interesting thing is that you actually had two states that went blue, those being Maine and Washington, where the young vote actually went to the Bush-Cheney team.
Okay, well, that's two states. We'll take 48.
Well, the youth vote victories were actually in 23 states, and that included two blue states. So typically in such a stronghold, a lockdown, if you will, the Democratic Party young voters were making inroads. But the important thing to remember is that young people like myself who are involved politically, they do provide two things in election. One is their own vote, which obviously they get energized and vote for the candidate of their choice. But the second thing is their ability to actually make an influence in the election by volunteering their time, getting some of their friends to come in to make the calls, to pound the lawn signs, and to knock on the doors. And if you saw that nationwide, the College Republican National Committee was able to mobilize thousands of 72-hour volunteers to go into critical swing states and make up the difference. So the power of one vote multiplied by perhaps 5 or 10.
And, of course, the Democrats did so as well. The young armies were out in force all across the nation. And the youth vote increased along with the rest of the national vote. But I guess I want to ask you if you believe all these polls that show that a lot of people came out because of values. Now, of course, the poll that everyone's citing is the one exit poll, a national exit poll. So what's the main reason that you came out to vote today? It included terrorism, Iraq, the economy. And some 22% said it was values. And a lot of people have been citing that poll because of those people that said that, some 85% went to George W. Bush. And I've been listening, Tom, to all kinds of right-wing talk radio shows, and they're saying it's all about abortion and the right of gay people to get married, and that was the main thing that drove this values vote. I want to know if you agree.
Well, when people look at their core values and what they want to see the direction of America going, first you can say that democracy is alive and well in the United States as far as the largest voter turnout and the highest number of people registering for this election than ever before. And you can see that there's people within the United States who believe in certain things and want things to happen, and they're motivated and they get out to the polls. So, yes, it's true. If you believe what the polls are saying, a lot of people were thinking it was going to be terrorism, a lot of people thinking it was going to be the war in Iraq. But in the end, I think as people looked at their kids and then went into the polling booth, they thought, hey, I want an America the way it's always been, and I don't want these drastic changes.
Well, let me ask you the question that I was asking when you called in, and this is a question from Michelle, and she's a listener, and she wants me to relay this concept to you, that if she wants to have a lifelong relationship with a woman, and she doesn't call it marriage in the dictionary, the state doesn't call it marriage, but it calls it civil unions, and she's given absolute equal rights to any straight couples, is that something that you would support? Is that something that a lot of Republicans would support? Is that something that a lot of, let's say, evangelical Christians would support?
Well, I obviously can't speak for the whole evangelical Christian community, and don't feel like I have the authority to do that. But I can say this. In Utah, specifically, we did, in this past election, pass an amendment to the Constitution of Utah defining marriage between a man and a woman, and it was 33 words and went beyond to say that nothing else basically can be called something else and be considered a marriage. So I think if you're going to have the will of the people, whether that's in California, Oregon, Missouri, or Utah, are saying that we want to keep within our state marriage between a man and a woman, but yet other organizations or special interest groups come by and they say, well, we're just going to call it something different, whether that be a civil union or a joint bringing together or different words that are used, it's still what it is. Just calling it a different name doesn't change or take away from that. So the will of the people have spoken, I think that needs to be followed, not just play with names.
Okay, so the bottom of the line is, let's get it straight, Tom, we're not going to play with names. It's not really about marriage. The will of the people in Utah is that gay people, gay couples, not have equal rights as straight couples. They should officially be second-class citizens under the law, you know, that they just aren't equal. They're not good enough to be Americans like everyone else. That's the will of the people. Is that what you're saying, Tom?
Well, in the 11 states that passed, each of them had a different exact wording of their specific interpretation of...
But let's see what you just said,
Utah. I would like to say that they're not going to be given additional rights, whereas in today's society...
What about equal rights?
They're not allowed to marry.
Right.
Well, the people within the United States of America are perfectly able to decide within their communities the context which they will have the government rubber stamp different relationships or...
You know, Tom, this is very interesting to me because this is exactly what happened in the South in the 1960s. You had the majority of people in Alabama, white people, the majority of people in Mississippi, the majority of people in South Carolina say, we don't think blacks should have equal rights. We think blacks are lesser than or we won't even say they're lesser than. We'll call it separate but equal, but they won't have the right to vote. They have to pay poll taxes. They need literacy taxes. They can't come to white movie theaters and restaurants. And the majority has spoken. As you pointed out, the will of the people have spoken. Shouldn't there be some civil rights, some basic right to, shall we say, equal protection under the laws that isn't put to a majority vote?
Well, I know that in taking that issue as far as gay marriage is concerned, I mean, there's a reason why a group of black pastors in the South got together in favor of the president's amendment to ban gay marriage in the U.S. Constitution, because they realized that there's a difference between using somebody's race, which nobody has control over, whether the issue of gay or sexual relations, where there's actually a debate whether or not people choose that lifestyle or how much they can engage in that lifestyle, whether they can go on both sides and different things.
Well,
so where the water is definitely a little bit muddier when it comes to straight up as far as race. That's why you have African-American, what churches they belong to, don't always appreciate it when the gay rights movement tries to piggyback on the racial movement.
Tom, I want to address this. I've been told by some of my listeners that there are problems with the website. I want to see if I can correct those. So hang on, listen in. If there's voice problems, we'll get right back right after this commercial break. If you're hanging on the lines, hang on. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Hear about George W.'s so-called mandate today on Hightower Radio. Here's today's multiple choice quiz. Dick Cheney is 1, loopy, 2, churlish, 3, thuggish, 4, dangerous, or 5? Dick Cheney is 1, loopy, 2, churlish, 3, thuggish, 4, dangerous, or 5? All of the above. Choose the combo. We saw all of these uglies come out in Cheney. After the election, John Kerry had barely finished his concession speech when Dick seized the national microphone to growl that the Bushites had not only taken the victory, but also won a mandate. So get ready, world, here they come. A mandate? They barely got 51% of the vote, meaning 49% of the people voted to toss them out on their duffs. A 2% margin is to mandate what near beer is to beer. Also, both pre-election polls and exit polls showed clearly a big chunk of people voting for George W. were actually strongly opposed to his agenda. So why did they choose him? Some were simply...
Yeah.
launching the privatization of Social Security, expanding the USA Patriot Act, and extending Bush's Iraqi war into Iran. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Bushites have no mandate for this mugging. To get information and help fight their power grab, call Campaign for America's Future, 202-955-5665.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and I get turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
What should Democrats...
Not just an ordinary taco, but this big, evil taco is haunting me. You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. ScorePower at Equifax.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I apologize. We had some technical problems there. These things happen on the radio and in internet broadcasting. It should be working fine now. If it's not, then please let me know again. I knew it was wrong because some of you listeners warned me. But we are going to continue. This is Mark Levine. Again, I'm talking with Tom Robbins. He is the Utah State Chair of the College National Republicans. And we're talking about the issues that divide the red states and the blue states. And one of those issues always seems to be, the big one that all the talk radio people talk about is it's gay rights. And maybe this was an election that we thought was about terrorism, the economy, or anything else. Maybe it was about gay rights. And what's interesting to me is that Tom seems to believe that the issue of civil rights can be put up for a vote, that it's the will of the people. And he says that basically you don't choose to be black, but you choose to be gay. I guess that's Tom's point. We'll find out in a minute. But, you know, I would say, Tom, to that, you know, I choose to be Jewish, and yet I still don't think I should be denied equal rights just because I'm Jewish. Can you really believe that civil rights like that should be put to a vote, Tom?
Well, obviously, the country has been the way it has for many years for a specific reason, that the government, in establishing marriage, gives its rubber stamp, or within the community, people are able to decide under which context, through their state legislator or through a stronger voice, which has been done in the 11 states this past election, through the Constitution, to speak very clearly upon which the context which they want marriage engaged. I'm also a proponent that says that there needs to be some changes within the marriage itself, within heterosexual couples. They're not saying that we're standing on the most solid foundation as far as divorce rates and other things, is that I think it's pathetic when young people grow up and almost 50% of their parents decide to basically cut their losses and split their ways, doing detriment to their children. There needs to be look at no-fault divorce. There needs to be looking at counseling and different options, trying to root out the problems before they grow.
But, Tom, assuming I agree with you on all of that, and frankly, I do agree with most of what you say, I do think divorce is a problem in America. How does allowing gay couples to also have, again, Michelle's comment was not marriage, but just civil unions, just the right to have the same equal treatment as straight couples, how does that in any way cause straight couples to divorce or harm the sanctity of their marriage?
Well, first, basically what is being trying to be done there and spun is that, okay, we won't call it marriage because that's a word that invites some kind of response and within the community and such that they'll pass a constitutional amendment. So we'll call it civil rights or put a different label on it, thus to be able to confuse people, but we still want the same rights basically in a marriage. In the state of Utah, even though the constitutional amendment was passed, people still have, through the power of their attorney, to be able to get visitation rights or pass on inheritances or other things.
No, they don't. They have to pay taxes on it. I mean, you know that, Tom. Maybe you don't know. If you will to a complete stranger, okay, you can't will more than a certain amount or you have to pay very large taxes on it. But you can will to your spouse all your belongings without any tax. The same is true with visitation in a hospital. You have to have special arrangements, a signed durable power of attorney. I don't know many people in America that have it. Those that do, that's great, you know, but you have to pay thousands of dollars to a lawyer to get that
well, maybe
set,
you should lower
set up.
Your fees, Mark.
No, it seems to me that Michelle's question, it seems to me, actually, here's the big secret, and I shouldn't tell you our game plan, but it seems to me that if Democrats were to put amendments on in all these states, and the amendments said this, they said, no government of the state of Utah or Kentucky or wherever shall interfere with the right of a church or synagogue or other religious institution to determine marriage as they choose, you know, between a man and a woman. But everyone shall have equal rights under the law with regard to the government. Oh, you could probably find a better way to phrase that. But the point is that I think people just don't understand the difference between civil marriage and religious marriage, and they think that gay people want the right to go into the Catholic Church and force them to do gay marriages, when really all these gay couples want, as Michelle's pointing out, is simply the right for the state to treat them equally with everybody else. I'll bet if we were to phrase those laws like that, we might overturn some of the worst aspects of these laws you're talking about.
Well, really what they want is to go into liberal areas such as Massachusetts, where the court has dictated to the state legislature what will be the context of marriage, get married there, and then return to a state like Utah, Oregon, Missouri, or any of the other states that have passed constitutional amendments defining marriage between a man and a woman, and demand before that state and its courts the same equal protections under the law that they would have in Massachusetts.
Well, of course, that's a separate question. States don't have to recognize other states' marriages, and that's a separate issue.
Well, I think that the people who are behind, basically, or who are against the amendment in Utah and other places, they want to travel down that road. There's no doubt about it.
I think they're people that are just trying to live their lives and don't want other people controlling their lives. It just seems to me, at the end of the day, America should be about live and let live, and leave people alone and not have people say, oh, you don't follow my religion, therefore you have to do X, Y, or Z. I mean, I think the same thing's true in the abortion debate. People think abortion is right or wrong, but they don't want other people telling them, if you don't do it my way, the government's going to coerce you to do it my way. That just doesn't seem to me to be the American way.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I think what you need to do then is push for Howard Dean to be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, which he has indicated that he has some interest in doing, and I'm sure he'll push that agenda, and I'm sure every election the Democrats will get less and less of the total vote.
Actually, I don't think so.
They'll just continue to lose seats in the House and the Senate.
The polls I've seen have shown 27% of Americans support the right of gay couples to get married, 35% are against any form of civil unions, and 35% support civil unions. That puts those that want equal rights to be 62%. Even George Bush has said he would consider civil unions. But let me go to the phones. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Tom Robbins.
Hey, you're a big California fan here. And Tom, in for those of us that voted on moral issues, such as why is our present administration bankrupting the country, awarding illegal contracts to insider corporations, those are moral issues. Why have we invaded a country that did nothing to provoke us, and we learn now had really no ability to provoke us? Why can we waste a moment of our time worrying about something like whether or not gay people want to get married?
Tom, isn't war an important moral issue?
Well, as far as the overall scope is that there's a difference in between opinion, probably between myself and the caller and myself and you, Mark, is that the society which we live in is made up of different things, whether that we're at war or we're at peace or whether our tax structure is. But there's many of us who feel that you can't separate your private life from your public life, that you can't necessarily just put up, you know, dividers and walls and build kind of a separate between everything. And that who gets married and what is defined as marriage and people who are allowed to come together or not makes up an equal part, just as other parts of our society. You can't just separate the two and say, well, this person has a problem with his morals, but he's okay here, here, and here.
But I think the question, though, is broader. I mean, it seems to me, as a fairly religious person myself, that most religions, I know they talk all the time. Every religion I know of, certainly Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, talks about caring for the poor. They say that you are to be judged by those that are least among us. I know there's a story, for example, in the New Testament, which you're probably familiar with, Tom, where a rich man comes to Jesus and says, how can I serve you? And Jesus says, sell all your belongings and give it to a poor person. And the rich person walks away. I don't recall Jesus ever saying anything very clearly about either unborn children or about gay couples, and yet he consistently is talking about caring for the poor, and yet it seems to me the Republican Party is making the tax burden higher on the poor. They're actually, you know, cutting taxes for the very wealthy and apparently trying to end Social Security. Isn't that indeed a moral issue, Tom?
Well, unfortunately, I think what has happened, liberals, as they're looking at this election and trying to analyze it as far as what went wrong, is they've basically come out with a very venomous attack in different, you know, op-eds, whether that's the New York Times or talk radio or different things, that are focusing, I mean, they're calling people a faith Jesus freak. They're saying that the only reason why, you know, Bush was elected is because, you know, there's people, conservatives, who just hate America and who hate other people and are intolerable Jesus freaks. And it's unfortunate that any time that you have...
No, but Tom, I'm defending Jesus. I'm telling you about something that I'm sure you're aware of in the New Testament. Jesus cared about the poor. The question isn't shouldn't religious values... Shouldn't, if you care about religious values, shouldn't you care about providing for the poor? Isn't that something that certainly the prophets and Jesus talk about far more than unborn children and gay weddings?
Well, obviously, the teaching of Christianity encompasses a lot of things. That's taking care of the poor. It's a sense of morality. It's the Ten Commandments written by the finger of God himself as far as dictating appropriate behavior to his children. The question lies in what is the best mechanism to deliver that help or to raise up. And you look at the situation in Washington, D.C., I think we were talking a little bit earlier, that they voted for John Kerry 93%.
Right.
So they're very...
About 90%.
90%, okay. Way up there.
Yep.
They aced that test.
Yeah, so. Yes. And the District of Columbia is the blue state district in the country, and Utah is the reddest of the red state.
Yeah, so when you're looking at that situation, you also have to look at who runs Washington, D.C., and quite frankly, in a very direct way, and unlike anywhere else in the country, it's the federal government. And the federal government has provided these services and promises and funding. In fact, I think per pupil more is spent in Washington.
But Tom, you're getting off the topic. Can we agree?
The point being, Mark, is that the federal government just, quite frankly, is not the best mechanism to deliver the help and the sustenance that people in poverty or that people who are reaching out need.
And so let's just see where we agree, and then I'm going to give Dave one last comment, and then we'll go to commercial. We agree that helping the poor is a moral value, is a religious value, right? We agree on that. Where we disagree is the best way to help the poor. Is that fair?
Well, I think the fair thing to say is that everybody wants to help the poor. It's just a matter of the best way of doing it.
And it's a religious value. It's a moral value.
To help the poor? Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. I just want to get some basic agreement here. So we agree it's a moral religious value to help the poor, and we disagree on the best way to help the poor. The Democrats think that actually with the poor having more money helps them. The Republicans think that with the rich having more money helps the poor.
Well, that's a mischaracterization. Obviously, the federal government is not a good steward of money. We've seen that before.
So give it all to Halliburton because they're better stewards.
And their deliverability as far as – and it also says in the Bible that you have to liberate the captive. And whether or not the Democratic Party or the Peace Party of Howard Dean felt that it wasn't appropriate to go in and liberate Iraq, or it wasn't, or the way to get...
Yeah, but you're not answering my question about how to help the poor. Dave, you got one last comment to make, then I'm going to move on to another caller.
Mark, you voiced my concerns better than I could. Tom, I think you are one of many that has really a devastating sense of priorities. We are doing so much wrong. Why would we worry about something so irrelevant, so insignificant? How would it trouble you to, you know, if gay people want to get married? Isn't it? It's irrelevant.
Well,
thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Dave.
It's irrelevant. Very clear place whether which way our society will be going in the future as far as what will be allowed and the different morals, and I think it's a slippery slope.
What's interesting, Tom, is that on this particular issue, you're very unusual among young people. I've noticed in the polls that on issues of whether gay people can get married, it's overwhelmingly the elderly that are against it, and young people overwhelmingly say, you know, live and let live. So maybe in Utah it's not the case, but in most of the country.
Well, interesting enough, I've also seen some other polls which show that though there's an increased tolerance perhaps among young people for gay marriage, there's actually more people than ever since the 73 Roe versus Wade decision in my age generation that actually want to see it overturned and actually want to protect life. So it's kind of an interesting balance, young people trying to figure out where they fit within society and what's acceptable and what's not, where they want America to go.
What percent of young people do you think want to overturn Roe v. Wade?
You know, I'll have to get that for you next time. But I would.
Okay. It's certainly not the majority. We can be clear on that.
I'm going to look up those facts.
All right. Look it up, and next week you can tell us. Let me quickly go to a caller, then we can express his or her point, then we'll go to commercial. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Tom Robbins.
Hey, guys. How you doing? I think I heard Tom say that he's not... He doesn't think it's the federal government's job to help out the small guy. But what about federal, I can't speak today, corporate welfare that we're giving all these corporations? Well, what's with that if we can't help the little guy?
It's a fair point. Brian, I want you to hang on, and I'm going to give Tom the whole commercial break to think about the answer to that question because it is a difficult one. Hang on. If you want to call in and ask Tom or me a question, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
The wails of despair from progressive friends began pouring through my telephone very early on November 3rd. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? We'll have to move to Canada. I can't take another 4 years. It's so much to bear. I give up. Get a grip. Yes, the Bushites are back, and yes, it's going to be a miserable 4 years of grueling battles as they push their agenda of more war, more right-wing appointments to the courts, more giveaways to corporate power, more pollution, more cuts in public services, more assaults on Social Security, more secrecy, more shredding of our liberties, more Bush. But give up? Give up the fight for our essential American values, the values of fairness, justice, and opportunity for all? Surrender our nation's historic possibilities to these ideological zealots and corporate frontmen? Not a chance. What are we going to do? Fight back, that's what. First, recognize that we're fighting from strength and are tantalizingly close to winning. 49% of voters not only were with us in this election, but strongly with us, including more than 60% of young voters. Our grassroots organizing this time was stupendous, giving us new expertise, tools, and outreach to keep advancing. And you can count on the Bushites to give this year's non-voters and wary Bush voters more and more reasons to get active with us. Second, recognize that fighting for democracy is always a long-haul proposition. It took decades for America's founders to build enough public support to break with England. Likewise, the abolitionists, suffragists, populists, labor, civil rights, and other movements didn't achieve their historic successes on their first outing, and it'll require the same perseverance on our part. This is Jim Hightower saying, we've just begun to lift our country up. As Willie Nelson says, the early bird might get the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese.
The holiday taste of Sam's Club is here. Save time and money by shopping for all of your holiday business and home entertaining needs in one convenient stop. Visit the club this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to sample a variety of delicious food perfect for any occasion. While you're there, you can pick up gifts for your employees, family, and friends. During this busy holiday season, don't miss your chance to shop, sample, and save on all of your business and home entertaining needs at the holiday taste of Sam's Club this weekend. Sam's Club, we're in business for small business.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital the government does not want you to know. And we're having a red state, blue state face-off here, trying to understand each other, trying to understand how each other thinks. I'm, of course, reporting from Washington, D.C., the bluest place in the country, where 90% voted for John Kerry. And I'm talking with the state chair of the Utah College Republicans, Tom Robbins. He's in the reddest state in the country, Utah, that went 71% for George W. Bush. Are we ever going to understand each other? I don't know. We've been talking about moral values. And my caller on the line, Brian from New Jersey, a blue state, I should add, he's asking, basically, Tom, if it's a moral value to help the poor, which Tom conceded in the last half hour, then how is it that we're not allowing poor people to have keep more of their money, right? They're paying a higher tax burden. They're paying Social Security taxes that rich people are getting lots of they're getting tax cuts and their dividends and their inheritance taxes, while poor people pay Social Security taxes. We're not giving the poor people more money. Instead, we're giving money to corporations like Halliburton, no bid contracts, things like that. How does that help the poor? Brian, did I fairly express your question?
More or less, but just the whole corporate welfare, how they're getting exactly tax cuts for being able to send workers across seas, and we can't give a poor mother with, you know, five or six kids welfare or enough welfare to live, and we're not giving her any jobs because we're shipping her jobs over to China.
One of the things George W. Bush did do is he cut the poor people's earned income tax credit. Basically, it's a child tax credit. If you earn under $11,000, you're pretty poor, you get a child tax credit. He raised taxes, if you will, on the poor. Tom, how can any of this help the poor?
Well, I think making very, very broad, sweeping generalizations as far as, you know, what has been done and what hasn't been done. And you're looking at corporations who sometimes get breaks and such things. Such things as outsourcing is inevitable, which can't be stopped. John Kerry himself basically said, look, I cannot stop outsourcing. It's just the way that the economy is going. I'm not going to stand up in front of you and say that you can. And then he'd attack the president for every single outsourcing job.
Okay, but we're not talking about outsourcing. Two issues, poor people and corporate welfare.
Well, I think poor people have been giving, as far as the Republican Party is concerned, the last couple of years. We're the ones who have led the fight and pushed Bill Clinton in the direction of actually welfare reform and trying to take a stagnant system and make it and stimulate it in such a way that it'll try to improve people's lives, try to help them find a way off welfare so it doesn't become a generation gap. I'm from, you know, Chicago area growing up and going down to the White Sox stadium. You can always see the Cabrini Green and different projects that have such been torn down because they were, after years of experimenting, found to be a complete and utter failure because you had generation of generation after generation. They got up to about a third generation.
Okay, but Clinton supported welfare reform. Kerry supported welfare reform.
So does the Republican Party.
Well, and so does the Democratic Leadership Council, the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. We had welfare reform, and indeed poverty dropped every single year of Clinton's presidency. Poverty increased every single year of Bush's presidency. Why do you think that is? It's Clinton's fault somehow?
Oh, no, I'm not blaming this on Clinton at all. You had a shift in the economy after we had basically George W. Bush inherited an economy that was on a downward swing.
Fair enough, but didn't he make it worse? I mean, he cut unemployment insurance. He cut child care and after-school care for poor women. He cut the poor people's earned income tax credit. It seems to me that when poor people need money, you know, George Bush is not going to help them. He's going to funnel that money to Halliburton and
to very rich people. There's not a gate between the poor people and Halliburton. That's just open and flooded through the Bush administration.
It's two separate issues.
The Bush administration, as far as welfare is concerned, has tried to pick up that gauntlet because the vast majority of Americans feel that it's a system that is stagnant and need to be reformed, and they've moved in that direction. I don't know the specifics about the very, you know, specific cuts that you're talking about, and I could look at those. but it's plain to see
generally,
that the old welfare system is old, decaying, and there's kind of a painful transition. But
let me just one thing as a religious person. Jesus' idea that a rich person who really wants to get to heaven should sell all his belongings and give it to a poor person, you wouldn't agree with Jesus, really, that that's the proper moral thing to do.
Well, I think in that situation, if that rich person gave his money to an organization, in this case the federal government, you could say, and that federal government wasted all that money, I think many of it and much of it would be in vain. You always want to see the highest amount of the money being able to go directly to those that are in need.
Sure, but if it goes to Halliburton and to very rich people, how does that end up trickling down to the people in need? That's what I don't understand. If you have to admit, did not do anything to lower poverty in America. In fact, poverty increased. Maybe they had other goals, but it certainly wasn't helping the poor, was it?
The stimulation of the economy is a long process, which is not going to happen overnight. And there's different, you know, areas and stuff. You know, John Kerry wanted to raise the minimum wage, which, if you do that, is actually going to take away jobs, is actually going to enforce employers to lay people off, and would actually increase the amount of people which would be in the poverty level because of their inability to find jobs in a very arbitrary.
Because all the Republicans are calling Democrats liberal elitists. Your argument is that all those poor people that consistently vote overwhelmingly to increase the minimum wage, in 70-80%, that really they're just ignorant, they don't know what's in their best interest, they'd be better off if they had less wages and somehow they'd get more jobs, right? All these poor people are just ignorant? Is that your view, Tom?
Well, talk about putting words in my mouth.
Why are they voting for the minimum wage if it's against their economic interest?
Well, all you have to do is talk to the small business owners of America who make up the vast majority of business. It's not that people...
Oh, no, I understand it costs more for business. No, I understand that it costs more for business, the minimum wage. I understand that. But our question was, how do you help poor people? And you made the statement that if you raise the minimum wage, it hurts poor people. I understand it transfers more wealth from businesses to poor people. I understand that it hurts the local business. They have to pay higher wages to poor people. But it certainly helps the poor people.
Well, in the very short term, people might see a brief economic upswing. But in the long term, businesses, because they'll have to be able to compete in the global environment, will end up laying off more workers to be able to do slightly higher pay than actually spreading that out to more workers who would have been employed under the old system.
Brian, you got one last point to make, and I want to move on to other topics.
I was just going to say that I guess it really just comes down to free trade, because with free trade right now, we are just going to keep increasing the amount of poor in our country, and hopefully we can stop that.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call, Brian. I would hope that, again, using the language of religion and of values, people need to look and see what religions teach, what the prophets of the Old Testament taught, what Jesus taught, what Islam, Buddhism, all of them teach about caring for those less fortunate. And I just don't see the Republican plan doing that. And maybe the answer is, well, people are selective. But if they're selective about the Bible, then how can they insist that the Bible really make laws for all the rest of us? I want to move on, though, and I want to ask you, Tom, about a couple things. One, about our war in Fallujah right now, our battle in Fallujah. Back several months ago, I was arguing that we needed to go into Fallujah then, that we shouldn't just withdraw, that was actually, you know, helping the terrorists out. Do you think that George Bush waited till after the election to begin this battle?
No, there's different logistic things that have to come into place to be able to do that. I think it's obviously catch-22. If he would have done it before, he would have gotten criticized. If he wasn't fully prepared to be able to go in there, and we would have took higher casualties. If you do it after, of course, every single liberal and person who didn't vote for him in America is crying somewhat of foul. So it's kind of a catch-22. If he did it before, he'd be yelled at. If you took casualties, if you did it afterwards, even if he's successful, he's discredited and yelled at by the left.
But it does say, but he did wait till after the election. He didn't do Fallujah based on the best timing. I mean, you don't think it's a mere coincidence that a few days after the election we're going to Fallujah?
You're asking me whether or not the commander-in-chief would politically put our soldiers at risk.
Yeah.
What I know from George W. Bush and the people that I've talked to who know him, and I would just categorically say directly, the commander-in-chief would not, for political purposes, put our troops in harm's way.
Well, you know, one of the things interesting on that in terms of timing is of course, that statement that Andrew Card made back in August 2002, which is that they didn't begin the Iraq War stuff in August because you don't sell a new product in August. They waited till September. I think we've seen examples of timing that are quite political. And, you know, the Republicans accused Clinton of the same thing. They said,
right,
when,
Bosnia. I mean, how do you feel? I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think the answer is that Clinton responded right after we were attacked. We were attacked in Kenya and Tanzania, and then Clinton responded by bombing those al-Qaeda training camps. It happened to be, yes, during the Monica Lewinsky affair, but if you look at the time frame, that we were bombed, I believe, in October of 98, and the attacks were 2 months later, so I don't see these things as being... I mean, I can understand it takes 2 months to do an attack. I can't understand why it would take 7 months to respond in Fallujah to those attacks.
Well, we're at a war, and different things are as far as setting it up and trying to take as minimal amount of casualties as we can. You can take the side if you feel that's appropriate, that obviously Bill Clinton was above the cuff, that he was above reproach. And you know,
no, I don't say he's above reproach.
Ethically, and he didn't politicize.
No, I don't say he's above reproach. I just think that this is a president who does, at least in the timing of things... I'm not saying he's going into Fallujah to harm American lives. I actually support going into Fallujah, but I do think the timing is suspect. I want to also ask you about John Ashcroft. He is now no longer going to be Attorney General. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as far as I know, I had the opportunity to go to a luncheon with Alberto Gonzalez, and he is very sharp, very professional, has a complete understanding of what I think he's going to need to do. And though, as far as I know, up until this broadcast, it hasn't been officially announced, everyone's kind of placing their bets in D.C. and within the Beltway that Alberto Gonzalez is the front runner for this job.
Well, I've heard that, too. One of my concerns about Alberto Gonzalez, who is the president's chief counsel right now, is that he wrote a memo a couple years ago basically saying we don't have to abide by the Geneva Conventions and that torture is okay. And no one's – I mean, this memo was used, in fact, as – a basis for the torture that went down not just in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, but also in Guantanamo Bay. And in fact, recently 60 Minutes reported on an American soldier, an American GI, who pretended to be a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay and got beaten within an inch of his life, actually got a concussion until he finally said, "I'm a U.S. GI." And I should also note that my sources tell me that we've killed 2,000 people in military prisons, although that obviously won't come out until after...
Well, I don't know what your sources are, but I will say this. It's going to provide an interesting kind of backpedaling or within the liberal community, because Alberto Gonzalez, whatever you think of him, is a very sharp individual.
I agree. He's smart.
He's risen to be the president's chief counsel. Now, if he's confirmed and he's allowed to have this position... high stature, people within the Democratic Party have always claimed that they have a monopoly on helping those people who are quote-unquote minorities to get a step ahead. But if you look at the Bush administration, all the top people or some of the very key critical people within the administration just happen to be, I think it's just a side note to their qualifications, happen to
you
be
do.
People of different colors.
You do. I, because if Democrats were to do that, they would call it tokenism. Look, the guy's Latino. That's fine. That's good. Latinos in government.
It's an interesting thing because you have a section of the Democratic Party that wants minorities to succeed unless they're conservative. Thus, people sometimes in the Democratic Party don't even consider Clarence Thomas African-American, and there's jokes made about that, or that they consider different people within the administration who are far, far, far highly qualified, such as Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice, to be yes men or yes women.
Well, first, okay, Tom, first of all, it's not true. All right, Colin Powell, in fact, a lot of Democrats, I think, respect Colin Powell, don't consider him a yes man at all. I think there's a little bit less respect for Condoleezza Rice. And Clarence Thomas, I don't think anyone can argue, was not a case of affirmative action. Republicans claim they don't believe in affirmative action, but here's a guy who was ranked not well qualified by lawyers and judges across the country when there were plenty and plenty of African-American lawyers and even conservatives that could have been appointed in his place. My question is not about Alberto Gonzalez, the fact that he's Latino. My question, Tom, and I want you to address this question when we get back from commercial, is what do you think of Gonzalez's memo that said two things? One, we don't have to follow this international law, Geneva Conventions, and two, it's just fine to have torture in these prisoners that we take. Don't you think that's a problem, or maybe you think that's okay? I want you to answer that question, and if you want to call in, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or write to the blog. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this. Yeah.
that a political party can do is to abandon its reason for existence and try to become a pale imitation of the other party. Yet this is exactly what some of the so-called political pros are prescribing for Democrats. The latest conventional wisdom from these insiders is that Bush's election is a triumph of moral values over such big issues as war and the economy. George W., they say, bluntly professes that he's guided by God, thus causing evangelical Christians to vote for him, even against their economic self-interest. Therefore, they assert, Democrats can't win until they get like George and start appealing to Christian fundamentalists. Nonsense. Certainly, the working people and poor folks who are in those churches must be appealed to by Democrats, but not like George, not on the narrow basis used by Republicans, God, guns, and gays. Rather, Democratic candidates must openly profess, by word and deed, the deeply held fundamental moral values that the party was created to represent: fairness, justice, and opportunity for all. This is high moral ground, which the Bushites routinely desecrate with virtually all of their policies and actions. Yet it's ground that Democrats senselessly have abandoned. It's not that evangelical working-class Christians voted against their own economic self-interest on November 2nd, but that the Kerry campaign had failed to appeal to it with any clarity or credibility. The candidate himself was aloof, elitist, and surrounded by upscale professionals, and the campaign gave little sense that a Kerry administration would be an FDR, JFK, LBJ champion of America's underdogs. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, Democrats must talk more directly about values, the core Democratic values that make the party important. These are not only the values that founded America, but in church terms, they're the values preached and practiced by Jesus.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. ScorePower at Equifax.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I'm discussing the issues with Tom Robbins, State Chair of the Utah College Republican National Committee. And we're talking about values. We're talking about the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. And before we went to break, I asked Tom about the suggestion that actually he brought up that probably the person to replace Attorney General John Ashcroft would be the president's counsel, Alberto Gonzalez. And Tom went on and talked about the fact that Gonzalez is Latino. He is Latino, but to me that's not the issue. Back in the 90s, in fact, Bill Clinton tried to appoint a judge by the name of Paez and tried for 4 years. The Republicans wouldn't even let it come up for a vote. The same thing they're complaining the Democrats are doing, in fact, in the Senate. So the Republicans wouldn't let Paez come up for a vote, come up for a hearing. But I didn't hear Democrats say, oh, Republicans, you're anti-Latino. We understood that the Republicans didn't like Paez for his relatively liberal views. My question about Alberto Gonzalez has nothing to do with his being Latino. I really don't think that card is fair to play. To me, the question is, this is a guy who believes we don't have to follow international law, the Geneva Conventions on protecting prisoners of war. This is a guy who believes that we can torture prisoners of war. And I guess I want to know from Tom if that, he thinks, is a, I don't know, a Republican value.
I think all Americans realize that after September 11th, we live in a difficult time in which terrorists can attack at any moment and can instill fear and take down our economy and wreak havoc on our social structure within the United States and play on our fears. In a situation where a terrorist could potentially have information to avert an attack or would have potentially harming information which could be detrimental to the the lives of thousands, if not millions, of Americans, there needs to be a situation where we're able to extract that information. Now, we're walking a very thin tightrope in doing this, and Alberto Gonzalez has tried to be able to, within the current context, figure out where we need to go on this. But he's a qualified person. I've been able to meet him and shake his hand. I think he'll do a wonderful job. And if he's brought into this post and he's able to get the confidence of the American people, he'll do wonderful things. But he deserves that chance, and he'll do great things.
Tom, do you think an American GI captured by an Iraqi or perhaps by the North Vietnamese 40 years ago, if that American GI were tortured, he would give up more American positions and talk more and let the enemy know what we're up to?
Do I think that perhaps in the Vietnam War or in the Korean War, if one of our guys was tortured, that they might give up more information?
Yeah, that's
my
question.
Well, I know that the Vietnamese, obviously, as we know, after the war, tried that, in some cases were successful, in some cases used our own American voices, whether that was Jane, you know, whether that was Fonda or other people. Some people would allude to that, actually.
Some gave up information, some didn't. My impression is that torture actually doesn't work as well as kindness. I've seen that, in fact, by a lot of organizations have shown that, in fact, when you're kind to prisoners, they're more likely to talk than when you torture them. But at the very least...
Well, I'm not an expert by any
means. I'm not an expert either, but it seems to me that we have an Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And at the very least, we should have a presidential counsel, and particularly an attorney general, who knows how to follow the law. We signed these treaties, the Geneva Treaties. I happen to think it's right. I happen to be against torture. But whether you're for torture or against torture, it is the law of the land. And I've got to say I'm very concerned about having an attorney general who doesn't want to follow the law of the land.
Well, I think Alberto Gonzalez will follow. In fact, I know he will. He'll be very qualified. And basically, the only way that he'll be able to govern is whether the American people accept where he's going and what he wants to do, which he'll do an outstanding job of doing.
One question
that needs to be asked, which I'd like to ask you, is,
yeah,
Mark, post-election, someone has to carry the banner for the Democratic Party. Do you or would you support Howard Dean as the national chairman of the Democratic Committee?
I have no problem with that. I think Howard Dean's got a lot of energy. I think he's someone who speaks very true to the issues of the day. He's not at all the liberal, outlandish liberal that he's been proclaimed in right-wing circles. In fact, he...
Right-wing circles being the established media, or...
Well, partly the established media, absolutely. Listen, Howard Dean, first of all, is very much supports the right of hunters to have guns. Howard Dean had a balanced budget every single year in Vermont. If only our president could do a balanced budget, but apparently Howard Dean is more fiscally conservative than George W. Bush. I think Howard Dean represents our party pretty well. Now, I don't make these decisions, but I'd have no problem with Howard Dean as our chair.
He could have some influence there as far as, you know, making some phone calls or getting people within the Liberal Democratic Party fired up about Howard Dean. I would just encourage you that that's the direction you need to go. If that's really where the future of the Democratic Party is with Howard Dean, perhaps Jesse Jackson could be the national executive.
No, I don't feel the same way about Jesse Jackson. I do have a lot of respect. I mean, I have some respect for Jesse Jackson, too, but I don't think he represents the middle of the Democratic Party. I do think that Howard Dean, though, has gotten a lot of unfair rap. The scream played again and again and again, one moment of exuberance in a campaign. You know, if they played again and again and again all of Bush's verbal missteps, then...
Well, they did, and not like they played Dean's scream. You had people like Michael Moore traveling the United States, playing his missteps over and over again,
But the mainstream press didn't do it. The mainstream press didn't do it very much.
The mainstream press didn't talk about Kerry's record in the United States Senate. So there's a balance between what they will talk about and what they won't.
Yeah, they talk about salacious stuff.
But at the end of the day, you can see that George W. Bush was elected president. And, you know, quite frankly, if you want Howard Dean to be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, I think, if nothing else, it'd be interesting.
I think he'd help us.
I think he's going to fall flat on his face.
I think he'd help us with grassroots support, and I think he'd help us raise a lot of money. I don't know all the people that are running. Maybe I'd find someone better. I didn't vote for Howard Dean in the primary. My regular listeners know I voted for General Wesley Clark. So he obviously wasn't my first choice for President of the United States, but I think he might make a fine chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Let me read for you some of the comments that I have on the blog here. Jenny writes in, do the red states have the opportunity to hear liberal views on local radio stations like we do in the blue states? And the answer, of course, Jenny, is no, they don't. There are, if you will, red state radio stations. You can go to San Francisco, certainly here in Washington, New York, Los Angeles. Go to the bluest of the blue cities, and you will find there's right-wing talk radio. But more liberal talk radio is a new thing. Frankly, when I came on air a year and a half ago, Air America didn't even exist. Air America is in some very small markets. And I know just from my listeners in Alabama, in Idaho, Alaska, Kansas, you know who you are. I have listeners in the red states who listen to me on the Internet because they can't get another point of view on the radio. And I would hope that Tom would agree that both points of view need to be expressed no matter where you live.
Well, in America, both points of view need to be expressed.
Okay.
However, people like Al Franken, I think, have jumped into the conclusion that, quite frankly, doing a radio show is something easy. And, hey, if people listen to Sean Hannity, why wouldn't they listen to me? And they're realizing that it's a very tough business. It's a day-in, day-out, lining up your guests, being able to have intelligent conversation, to be able to engage the audience, being able to not just go off on rhetoric, but actually reaching some conclusions and some common ground. And people like Al Franken or Michael Moore, I don't know, when they look at talk radio or their involvement in it, I don't think that's really what they want to do. They just want to basically get as crazy and as far left as they can and then spew it out. And quite frankly, there's just not a lot of radio markets that are able to support that because the majority of Americans don't.
Well, Tom, let me agree with you, first of all, that talk radio is tough. I know. I do it every day, and it ain't an easy business to do, and it ain't an easy business to break into. In fact, we had some technical problems just at the beginning of this hour. It is a tough business, no question about it. But certainly, there are enough liberals out there, and if you don't like my show, listen to someone else. Listen to Randy Rhodes, perhaps. But there are definitely people out there with as much quality programming as right as left. And in fact, I should tell you and tell Jenny and tell my listeners that I have been to several syndicators, just personally, who have told me, Mark, we like what you do. You have a good show. We really think you're a good radio personality. But our corporate bosses will not let us hire anyone left of center. And when they said this, I thought to myself, boy, that sounds like a Democratic conspiracy theory. But indeed, it is true. They are owned, radio stations are owned by big corporations that will tell you they will not hire anyone left of center. Now, Air America, I think, is showing that it can be done. I think it is changing. But I can tell you that a year and a half ago, people told me at radio conventions, oh, liberals don't listen to talk radio. They just listen to jazz. As if half the nation didn't want to hear people discuss things. And Jenny has a good point. She writes, I think the red states are more influenced by the rhetoric and biased preachings of the Republican Party. For example, over 70% of those who voted for Bush still believe that Iraq and 9/11 are connected. And, you know, I think you're right, Jenny. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think Fox News does a lot of it. And but, Tom, you know, right, that Iraq wasn't behind 9/11? You know that, right, Tom?
We know that it's a harbor for terrorists and people who would seek to destroy America.
Okay, but you're not going to claim Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11.
In 2004, the midterm elections, George W. Bush stunned all the pundits. He got out there, put his reputation on the line, and what he was doing, and personally canceled.
Okay, but Tom, you don't think that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, though, right? Can we get that straight?
Well, I think that Saddam Hussein personally pulled the trigger.
Do you think that he was part of the conspiracy to take those planes and fly them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon?
I don't know. I'd like to see Osama bin Laden interrogated before I meet him.
Okay, but you don't know of any evidence to that effect.
Not that I have, besides the fact that there is community.
All right, fair enough. I appreciate that. You're an informed person. My fear, though, is that a lot of the people that voted for George W. Bush are not as informed as you, Tom. I want to read one last comment where Jenny turns around and then doesn't like what I have to say. She says, Mark, why would you ever support going into Fallujah? You think the slaughtering of innocent people, whereby the injured can't even get medical treatment, they can't even leave their houses, doctors and nurses have been killed and or arrested, the hospitals have been taken over, and people aren't even allowed to care for the wounded. That's okay to you. No, Jenny, it's not okay to me. I think that the problem in Fallujah is that once we've gone to war in Iraq, a war that I didn't support, once we've gone there and our troops are attacked, we have to attack back, or it just leads to our troops being attacked more often. Now, do I think we should slaughter innocent people? Absolutely not. We've killed, according to one source, 100,000 innocent Iraqi civilians. There's absolutely no place for that in warfare. We need to selectively go out and get the people that attacked us. Now, we shouldn't be closing down hospitals. We shouldn't be killing or arresting nurses, any of that. So I do support going to Fallujah, Jenny, but obviously I think that there are ways to do it in ways that lessen casualties to innocent people, and we have to do that. We have to fight a war more humanely, than our enemies, because otherwise, if we torture just like they do, and we go in and we kill innocent people just like they do, then no one's going to see any difference between the United States and the rest of the world. And I do believe in moral values, and that's one moral value that I see, that we can hold our country, the United States of America, to a higher standard. Tom, you got 30 seconds if you want to respond to that.
Well, obviously George W. Bush is doing what is needed. He's doing what is right, and that is why he was reelected. And I'll just say this. The Democratic Party has lost seats in the last couple of elections. They were stunned in 2004 when George W. Bush put his reputation on the line and went out into critical swing states and campaigned, and we came out victorious, and we came out victorious again. Unfortunately, there's people within the Democratic Party that want Howard Dean to be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And I say to those people like yourself, Mark, if that's where you want it to go and if that's where you think Americans are actually headed and you're just ahead of the curve, pick up that banner, yell and scream, and go as far as you can and support him being the chairman, because you'll just see an alienating more people. More people will continue to vote Republican and will continue our majorities within 2008 and beyond.
It's a lot bigger than Howard Dean. The answer is, are we going to have moral values? And our moral values are not killing 100,000 innocent civilians. We think that's much more important, people who are actually here on Earth, than some of the values that some of the Republican Party are really concentrating on. Tom, I want to thank you very much for coming here again on the Inside Scoop. Welcome you back. We'll be talking again. This time you could hear my regular theme music, which isn't Kick Out the Republicans.
Nice not to hear Kick Out the Republicans.
Yeah,
because you opened up the door to kick them out, and a couple more of us came into
the
house.
Well, I'll tell you this, and I've got to close, but I'm going to be posting on the web an op-ed piece that I wrote, which makes it clear it isn't much of a mandate. In the House, if it weren't for Tom DeLay's gerrymandering maneuver, the Democrats would have won seats. In the Senate, every seat we lost was in the red states, and frankly, we picked up a couple in the red states. It is true that we are in a 50-